The headlines: Iran blames wrong U.S. policies, including its support of Israel, for instability in West Asia. The UK's ruling Conservative Party says Boris Johnson's successor will be announced in September, from among nearly a dozen hopefuls. Also ahead, Russia speeding up a process to offer citizenship to Ukrainians, in a move that Kiev says is proof of President Putin's aggressive appetite. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says the wrong policies of the U.S. are the main cause of instability in the West Asia region. Nasser Kanani says that West Asia will be safer and more stable if Washington puts an end to those policies. He said that Washington should end creating division among regional countries and to stop pouring arms into the region. The Iranian diplomat called on the U.S. to respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of regional countries as well. He also said the U.S. should stop backing Israel, as the regime is the biggest source of instability and organized terror in West Asia. Kanani said that Washington's unwavering support for the regime is a clear proof that the U.S. claim of seeking peace in the region is false. U.S. President Joe Biden has written an op-ed for The Washington Post, sharing his thoughts on the situation in West Asia, as well as U.S. achievements and plans for this region. However, it is ironic that he says the U.S. has helped with regional problems, like the issues of Palestine, Yemen, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, when it has been part of the problem.
President Biden has almost unlimited ways of communicating with the world, but he opted to pen an article posted online Saturday night by the Washington Post to defend his pending West Asia trip in light of the controversies around it. In the piece, he speaks about many issues, including further integrating Israel into the region, Washington's ties with Riyadh, the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the Iran nuclear deal, and more. While most of the matters mentioned in the article are centered around West Asia, they also seem to share another point. The U.S. itself is either complicit in or directly responsible for the very issues it claims that it is trying to solve.
The U.S. Lies through its teeth without stopping a minute. We've seen the debates and discussions about the comprehensive agreement with Iran, which they had promised to renegotiate, and they seem not to be negotiating in good faith. They're trying to paint themselves as innocent, which of course they are not. And they just had a recent rebuff at the G20 meeting in Indonesia, where Mr. Blinken refused to sit down with the leaders of all these states.
Saudi Arabia, infamous for its violations of human rights and under widespread criticism for its bloody war on Yemen as well as the killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, is a focal point of Biden's West Asia tour. But despite this, the U.S. president's framing of the Saudi relationship appeared particularly defensive. During his election campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah for its crime. But now he has ironically claimed that ties with Riyadh help promote the U.S.'s foreign policy ambitions. Similar to the other issues, the U.S. president also tried to take fault away from his administration in regard to the Iran nuclear program file by putting the blame on Iran. Biden also stated his readiness to further pressure Tehran despite Tehran's readiness to return to the deal, and this too sheds light on the U.S.'s ironical foreign policy.
The U.S. President Joe Biden's op-ed raises one immediate question. Why did he feel there was a need to write one in the first place? Nevertheless, it is reported that the main purpose of his trip to the region is to connect Israel with the Persian Gulf countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, through a defense pact. This is while Israel remains the source of regional problems, including attacking Syria, violating Palestinians' rights, and threatening Iran militarily.
One of the the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the so-called deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forwards with the Abraham Accords, which is the pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran. In the op-ed piece, President Biden says the U.S. helped end the 2021 war on Gaza, but fails to condemn Israel for its atrocities and violation of Palestinian rights. Biden also proudly mentions the U.S.'s $4 billion support of Israel. But what does all this demonstrate about the U.S.'s stance on Palestinians who have been subject to Israeli brutality for years now?
Well, the issue of the United States and Israel is a burning issue right now, and the U.S. has acted in a hypocritical way where Russia has attacked special military operation in Ukraine to denazify it, and we know what Nazis are. So, and yet, so the U.S. has spent $40 or $60 billion arming these countries, letting all those Ukrainian youth be killed who were forced into fighting Russia. And yet, with respect to Gaza, 8 months earlier, Israel unleashed a horrible attack on Gaza, and the U.S. hummed and hawed, tried to sort of say, maybe we'll calm things down. They didn't spend $40 billion to arm the resistance against Israel. And that is a term which I call tongue-in-cheek. I don't know whether you know the term. It's sort of a sarcastic term, because obviously the U.S. is not going to do that, but it's related to empire.
The U.S.'s one-sided stance on Israel is also clearly demonstrated in the Shirin Abu Akleh case, where it stopped short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing by Israeli troops, while all other investigations reached the conclusion that the regime troops did in fact murder her. Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seeks not only to integrate the regime further into the region, but also aims to advance its plans to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. And all this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is in Italy for an official visit. During his first day in Rome, he met with his Italian counterpart, representatives of the business community, and Iranians residing in the country. Max Chivoli has more from Rome.
On Monday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian landed in the Italian capital for a two-day visit to Italy. Amir Abdollahian's first meeting was at Italy's foreign ministry, where he met his counterpart Luigi Di Maio to discuss bilateral relations and recent geopolitical developments. Di Maio expressed satisfaction over the resumption of indirect talks between Washington and Tehran over the fate of a 2015 deal. The Iranian minister also stressed the importance of reaching a good, lasting agreement that would see Iran take full economic benefit from the historic agreement, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran's top diplomat also stated that Tehran is interested in having its natural share in the energy market and thereby helping the international community. His remarks came at a time when the global market is facing high oil prices due to the Western sanctions on Russia for its war on Ukraine. Over the past years, Italy, like other European countries, has lacked an influential role on Iran's most crucial international issues. According to analysts, the choice to maintain a low profile on Iran was driven by the hesitation of Rome in taking a confrontational stand towards the U.S.
Italy has been playing a diminutive role not only on the Iranian file, but on most international scenarios. Rome's geopolitical line seems to be too far aligned to that of the U.S. administration. It only remains to be seen if Italy's foreign minister's commitment to expand bilateral relations with Iran is more than just a generic pledge.
After holding talks with his counterpart, Amir Abdollahian met tens of Italian businessmen operating in Iran at the Iranian ambassador's residence. Here, entrepreneurs expressed their desire to intensify commercial ties. The Italian embassy in Iran has estimated that the trade volume between the two countries dropped from about 5 billion euros in 2017 to 1.2 billion euros in 2019, following the U.S. reimposition of sanctions.
Our economies are complementary. There is no rivalry at all. As a matter of fact, they complete each other. We are going through a highly interesting political phase in Iran. Furthermore, Rome and Tehran share 160 years of sound relations.
Also Monday, Iran's top diplomat met with representatives of the Iranian community residing in Italy. On Tuesday, the Iranian minister is slated to hold talks with high-ranking prelates at the Vatican. Max Civili, Rome.
The United Nations has recently published a report on children's suffering in armed conflicts around the globe. The report, however, has drawn criticism for excluding Israel and Saudi Arabia from an annexed blacklist. The report's title is Children in Armed Conflict and is released every year. It says that around 2,500 children lost their lives in global conflicts in 2021. The annual report sheds light on other violations, including abductions and sexual violence against children in conflict zones. The UN report also includes a blacklist intended to shame countries into implementing measures to protect children. But it has provoked controversy by leaving Israel and Saudi Arabia off the list. That is why the report itself stresses that Israeli forces have killed tens of Palestinian children in the year. In May 2021, the UN chief warned about the distressing situation of Palestinian children in Gaza. Antonio Guterres had compared the lives of Gazan children to a hell on earth. The ruling Conservative Party says the new UK Prime Minister to replace the outgoing Boris Johnson will be announced on September 5th. This is 11 hopefuls are currently vying for the job. Rob Carter, our correspondent in London, brings us the latest on the bitter fight developing and how it could affect the UK.
As the race for the leadership of the UK ruling Conservative Party heats up, the fight for who will become Britain's next Prime Minister turns ugly. With bitter exchanges, leaked dodgy dossiers, and attacks on rivals' policies, the contest could quickly turn into a large-scale brawl. A flurry of weekend announcements has put the total count of top job hopefuls at 11, a large number filled with big and small names. Rishi Sunak tops with the most Tory MP supporters so far, with pro-Brexit Trade Minister Penny Mordaunt coming in second. However, critics say a long drawn-out contest will deepen economic uncertainty amid a cost-of-living crisis.
What we're going to be faced with is more of the same. I mean, clearly, Boris Johnson brought the office of Prime Minister into further disrepute. And I just think that what we have before us are a number of candidates who are all committed to imperialism, all committed to neoliberalism. They're all warmongers at the end of the day. So we're just kind of rearranging the deck chairs rather than actually making any significant difference. It's a case of sort of parliamentary parlour games, really, rather than any meaningful change.
Onlookers also fear that the race is full of candidates who have a track record of concerning policymaking.
Priti Patel in particular, very close to the Zionist entity, had unofficial visits when she was on a ministerial tour when Theresa May was the Prime Minister and indeed got sacked as a consequence of that. It was Boris Johnson that brought her back in. You just got to go through all the runners and riders. I mean, they've all got a very sort of checkered history, to say the least. At the end of the day, they're Conservatives and, you know, they support a system which has actually impoverished millions of people in this country.
It's not yet clear who's going to come out on top in this race. However, one thing we do know for sure is that the next Prime Minister of the entire country is going to be decided by a minority group, paying Conservative Party members, much to the frustration of the majority electorate, who won't have a chance to say who the next Prime Minister will be. Robert Carter, London.
The Russian president has issued a decree to speed up citizenship for all Ukrainians more than 4 months after the start of Moscow's offensive in the war-torn country. Vladimir Putin's decree also enables stateless persons permanently residing in Ukraine to obtain Russian citizenship in a simplified manner. Putin had already fast-tracked citizenship for residents of two regions in south and southeast of Ukraine. Kiev has condemned the decree as worthless and proof of, quote, Putin's aggressive appetites. Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said the decree breaches Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity and is at odds with international law. He said that Ukrainians do not need Russian citizenship, warning that attempts to impose it by force are doomed to fail. A similar decree in 2019 allowed the same simplified citizenship procedure for residents of Ukraine's eastern breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Meanwhile, Kiev says at least three people have been killed and dozens more injured in Russian shelling of Ukraine's second-largest city of Kharkiv. The mayor of the northeastern city says the strikes targeted civilian buildings. Russia says its missiles have hit ammunition depots in Ukraine's central Dnipro region. The defense ministry says two Ukrainian army hangars storing U.S.-produced artillery pieces were also struck near the city of Konstantinovka in the Donetsk region, the current focal point of the battle. It says Russian forces also hit deployment points for Ukrainian troops and foreign fighters in the Kharkiv region on Sunday. Meanwhile, Ukraine's state emergency service said the death toll from Saturday's strikes on the eastern city of Chesiviar rose to 26. Thousands of people have been killed and over 6 million have left Ukraine since Russia launched its military offensive there on February 24. Family and friends bid farewell to former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, whose assassination last week shocked the country. The funeral service was private and held at a temple in the capital, Tokyo. Long lines of people came paying respect to the slain premier. Following the ceremony, the hearse carrying Abe's body proceeded through Tokyo, driving past landmarks, including the parliament building. Abe, 67 years old, was shot dead Friday during an election campaign rally in the western city of Nara. The shooter is in custody. He told police that he believed that Abe was linked to an organization that he resented. The killing sent shockwaves across the world. That is because gun crime and political violence are very rare in Japan. And that does it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we had a survey of Imam Khomeini's testament in a number of episodes, and last episode you heard the concluding part of the testament. Today you're going to hear his marriage with Lady Khadija Saghafi. Stay tuned for more. Thank you. Lady Khadija Saqafi was Imam Khomeini's wife. She was a virtuous lady while she was well aware of social and political developments of her time. A brief glance at her marital life shows that she was a very patient woman, as she had to accompany the greatest contemporary personality, Imam Khomeini, who successfully changed the course of history against the will of oppressors and tyrants. Miss Saqafi was the lady who tolerated the hard times of Imam Khomeini's arrest, several months separation, his life in exile in Turkey and then Iraq under tough conditions. This great lady was undoubtedly a major factor in all phases of the Imam's struggles and successes. Khadija Saqafi, also known as Qudsi and Qudsi Iran, was born in 1914 in a religious family. Her father, Ayatollah Mirza Muhammad Saqafi, was one of the great ulema in Tehran, whose ancestors were clergymen for generations. Her mother, however, was from a well-to-do family. Hence, Khadija grew up with no financial problem. Young Khadija lived 15 years with her grandmother, who had no child. Yet, the wealthy life didn't prevent her from acquiring ethical merits. She was a hard-working girl, and she spent her elementary school and part of her high school to learn French. This enthusiasm for knowledge continued through her marital life, even when she gave birth to her fourth child. Lady Khadija Saqafi endured all problems of migration to Qom and living in difficult conditions with Imam Khomeini, as the Imam was a pain in the neck of the Pahlavi regime. Lady Khadija Saqafi loved studying and would rarely spend her day without studying a book or a newspaper or a magazine. Recitation of the Noble Quran was also part of her daily works. She had also studied the Divan of Hafiz, Golestan of Sa'di, and many literary and historical books. She knew many poems by heart. Imam Khomeini's wife was so interested in reading books that the last years of her life she would ask others to read books for, as she could not read due to old age. Imam Khomeini was studying till the age of 26 in the holy city of Qom. He lived only with the money that received from his family in Khomein and would never accept the stipend that the sources of emulation sent to him. Miss Khadija Saqafi was introduced to Imam Khomeini by Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Lavasani, and the former accepted, as he had an old age friendship with Miss Saqafi's father. However, the difference of living conditions of the two families caused a wave of opposition against this marriage. Lady Khadija Saqafi writes on this: the opposition increased. Basically, it was considered impossible that I would be the wife of a seminary student. For these reasons, my dear father explained in detail to Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Lavasani as why this proposal was impossible. My father had told him that this was very problematic. This girl would not be allowed to cope with the life of a seminary student. It is true that Mr. Ruhullah Imam Khomeini is very pious and God-wary, who has gained the degree of ijtihad at a young age, and he has studied philosophy and irfan, Islamic Gnosticism, regularly, and is a man of both knowledge and practice. I know Mr. Khomeini, and I know that his knowledge is more than his age, and he has a bright future. Yet, Qudsi and her grandfather consider a big number of problems. The proposal for marriage was presented several times, but each time the answer was disappointing. Finally, Lady Khadija Saghafi gave the positive answer to the marriage proposal after 9 months. The positive answer was mainly because of the three dreams that she had seen. Khadija Saghafi relates one of her dreams as follows. I saw in a dream that there was a small room in a house in which three men were sitting while I and a lady who had a special chador were sitting in the opposite room. The lady answered my questions. I asked her as who those men were. She answered, the man in the opposite is the prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, who has a black turban. On his side, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, is sitting, who has a green turban, and on the other side, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, is sitting also with a black turban. I was very happy and asked, so these are my prophet and imams? She answered bitterly, but you do not accept them. As I was thumping my chest, I said angrily, what are you saying? I love them very much, and I consider myself among their ummah, and I have obeyed what they have said, and I will obey what they will say. At this time, I woke up. Thus, the ceremony of proposal for marriage was done shortly after the dream of Khadija Saghafi. Interestingly, the house of Khadija and Ruhullah was the same that she had seen in her dream. She writes, the day after the marriage, I noticed that this is the same house that I had dreamt. This is the same room where I had dreamt the prophet, the commander of the faithful, and Imam Hassan. Even the door and the window are the same which my mother had prepared for me after the dream.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The war in Yemen has experienced a back-to-back truce, badly needed one, given the humanitarian catastrophe in that country.
so bad that the Red Cross has said that two-thirds of Yemenis are deprived of basic health care in unimaginable horror. Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at this unimaginable horror, the U.S. complicity in this war. And even though the truce has been broken by the Saudis on more than one occasion, the reports that the U.S. may continue arms sales to the kingdom. Our guests joining us for this edition of the Spotlight are journalist and political analyst Yousef Mowry, who joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us, the founder and editor of the independent news website, Multipolarista, Ben Norton, who joins us from Managua.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Ben Norton, let me first start with you. We are looking at the fact that you have a humanitarian situation unfolding in the degree that it is. That's no surprise. But given that this point, we're talking about how the Red Cross says unimaginable horror and that two-thirds of Yemeni people are deprived of basic health care, why hasn't there been any headway made in that arena, given the fact that we're looking at somewhat of a truce that's now been held back-to-back? We're looking at 4 months of it now, roughly.
Well, the answer is because it's in the strategic interests of the West to continue this war after more than 6 years now. We see that the Joe Biden administration is trying to improve its relations with Saudi Arabia and essentially telling Riyadh that it's going to be able to continue waging this war. Now, Joe Biden has repeatedly claimed he wants to end the war, but the reality is that it's in the West's continued interest to support Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen and continue providing weapons and military support. And of course, if this were another country waging war on Yemen, like Russia, I think there would be an international outrage that was led by the West. But because it's the West that's backing this war on Yemen, and because the U.S. dominates media narratives and uses its political power to pressure other countries into silence, there's very little discussion of the fact that the people in Yemen are suffering from the worst humanitarian catastrophe on Earth. According to the United Nations, more than 370,000 Yemenis have died in this war, and that's a conservative estimate. And again, we have to ask why. Well, the answer is very clear. It's because the West is backing this war, and according to the West, anything that they want to do is supposedly justified.
Well, you're there, Yousef Mowry, in Sana'a, and when you take a look at the way that Yemenis speak about the West, as a guest there talks about, what West are they referring to that's basically unleashed through the Saudi-led coalition the horrors that is unfolding? Do they blame Saudi Arabia only? Do they blame the U.S.? Who are they blaming?
All of the above. That's who the Yemeni people are blaming. In fact, the international community, any country that is not speaking out against the Saudi coalition and U.S.'s continuous propensity to want to expand over, even if it means spilling the blood of tens of thousands of innocent people. Any country that's not speaking out or is remaining silent to the genocide that's taken place in Yemen, that's what the Yemeni people are blaming, but primarily Saudi Arabia, and of course its U.S. allies, right? You have Saudi Arabia, who's been receiving billions and billions of dollars worth of military aid from the U.S., and the Yemeni people have experienced the reality of what those weapons, what the repercussion of Saudi Arabia having those weapons is going to be. And that's going to lead into the death of tens of thousands of more innocent Yemenis. So again, to answer your question, anybody who is not speaking out against Saudi Arabia, against the U.S. for its continuous atrocities on Yemen, they should be held accountable and they should be blamed, right? Also, the UN Security Council, any UN entity that's, we have, I was here last week and, we did an interview about the humanitarian crisis in the country. And, we're throwing numbers of tens of thousands of innocent people dying, thousands and thousands of innocent children starving to death because of the blockade. And you have, Amnesty International, you have the International Red Cross, the UN all speaking out and, basically proclaiming that they want to help alleviate the humanitarian crisis. But that's not the fact. That's not the reality, because all they really want to do is, use the case, the humanitarian case in Yemen, to justify, making money, to justify getting donations from their sponsors, their donors. If they really wanted to end the suffering in Yemen, they would call on Saudi Arabia, call on the UN to lift the strangling blockade. The people are starving on the ground because of the blockade. Basic necessities is not able to enter the country. That's not because the Yemeni people are poor. That's not because Yemen doesn't have enough natural resources to feed its people. It's simply because there's an insidious blockade being imposed by the U.S., by the UN, and the international community, who are turning a blind eye to the atrocities that are taking place. When you look at what's happening in Ukraine, on the other hand, Amnesty International, the UN, every country has condemned Russia. And, they're claiming, this is a Russian invasion and Russia is killing innocent people and Russia is doing this and is doing that. Not one of these entities is holding Saudi Arabia accountable. Not one of these nations or these entities is pointing the finger at the crown prince or the king of Saudi Arabia to tell him enough is enough.
Indeed. Well, when you look at it through that lens that our guests there from Sana'a just talked about there, Ben Orton, it shows UN complicity. And the only thing that comes to my mind is how Saudi Arabia, along with the U.S., are major contributors when it comes to the funding of the UN. We've known about how Saudi Arabia has actually been excused by the UN when it came to killing children in the war in Yemen and countless of other situations where, they made excuses for Saudi Arabia. And, of course, this sheds another light and another angle to this. Do you think that that is the reason, if you agree with our guest there from Sana'a, that perhaps even the UN is complicit because this siege is not being lifted and people in Yemen are still suffering?
Well, we do know that the pressure of funding has been a significant factor in the United Nations inaction. In fact, the previous Secretary General Ban Ki-moon admitted that Saudi Arabia threatened to withdraw funding after the UN was going to put Saudi Arabia on its list of countries that violate the rights of children. So it's an objective fact that Saudi Arabia and the Western powers have used funding as blackmail to try to prevent the United Nations from taking action against this borderline genocidal war in Yemen. But we also know that inside the United Nations Security Council, which is the institution that has the most power, the U.S. has very frequently used its veto power to prevent any UN action. So I think it's very justified to criticize the UN, but at the end of the day, the weaknesses of the UN, I think, are reflections of Western imperialism and U.S. hegemony. The fact that the U.S. can use the UN to advance its geopolitical interests, and then when the UN tries to take actions that may in some way challenge U.S. interests, well, Washington can use its veto in the Security Council to block those resolutions. We've seen the United States many dozens of times has vetoed UN resolutions condemning apartheid Israel's illegal activities and occupation of Palestinian territories. So similarly, if the UN Security Council were to try to take action against Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, it's very likely that the United States and also potentially Britain and France would use their veto power to prevent any UN action against Saudi Arabia. So once again, Riyadh can only carry out this war and kill hundreds of thousands of Yemenis because it has support from Western imperialist powers. And honestly, if the United States were to say tomorrow, we are ending our support for this war, I think the war would end within a few days. But the response from the White House is, of course, the opposite. Instead, Joe Biden is saying, well, We want to improve our relations with Saudi Arabia in order to continue our war on Russia as well. So in Washington, the solution to all of these problems is never less war. It's always more war.
Well, let me open up then this question, which I'm almost sure that maybe you have either read it, Yusuf Mari, or you've heard about it at this point, and that is the op-ed that Biden, the U.S. president, has written prior to his visit to the region, titled Why He's Going to Saudi Arabia. I mean, there in itself shows the level of, I don't want to say disillusion, because obviously either Biden wrote it himself or somebody wrote it for him. But it really is a far stretch from the reality. And I begin with this, Yusuf Mari, where Biden says, the war in Yemen was escalating, creating one of the world's worst humanitarian crises with no political process. In Yemen, I named an envoy and engaged with leaders across the region, including the King of Saudi Arabia, to lay the foundation for a truce. What do you think when the U.S. president is saying that?
Well, he's obviously pushing the U.S.'s political agenda, and he's going to say whatever he's going to say to push that agenda. I mean, you have a president who's ignoring the death and the genocide of tens of thousands of innocent people in order to pursue and to continue the Western hegemonic international structure, right? And that's been the case. Biden, he's scheduled to visit Saudi Arabia in the next couple of days, and the reason why he's doing that is, the U.S. has a propensity to beef up its allies with military weapons in order to continue Western expansion and in order to continue the U.S.'s interest dominance over the region. But what's interesting about this visit, this visit actually, is that the U.S. and Israel, they're actually laying the groundwork for a new security alliance to be established between the U.S., between Israel, and most of the Arab states, most of the Saudi-backed coalition. And the purpose of this visit is they want to create or connect military technology to combat Yemen. They're actually building a network of radars, detectors, weapon interceptors, and they want to use this military technology, unprecedented military technology, to attack Yemen on demand. And not only attack Yemen, but they also want to counter any missile attacks by the Sana'a government toward Saudi Arabia or toward any of the countries that are waging this aggression on Yemen. And what's even more interesting is that the U.S. and the Israeli entity, they're actually using Yemeni islands, they're using Yemeni territory to build these military bases, to build these detectors, to build these sophisticated state-of-the-art radars. They're using the island of Socotra, they're using the island of Meitun, and this is all Yemeni land that's being used to point its weapons and to point its missiles towards the Yemeni people. So this is an unprecedented event where you have just think of NATO joining forces with the Arab coalition being led by the Israeli entity and the U.S. supreme military technology all joining forces to wage war on Yemen. This is, this is not propaganda. This is actually happening as we speak. So as we speak, in spite of the humanitarian crisis that's taking place on the ground, you have more military activity in preparation to wage an all-out war on Yemen. And from the looks of it, it's going to happen in the near future.
Mm-hmm. We're going to discuss that a little bit more. I need to open this op-ed more, because it's really incredible, Ben Norton, when you think about it. Another very controversial statement coming out of it, in a sense, is how the U.S. president says, after a year of our persistent diplomacy, this truce is now in place. News just came out today, exclusively, of course, internal U.S. discussions on Saudi arms at early stage, decision likely to depend on Saudi efforts to end the war. So you have the U.S. announcing potential arms sales. Biden did sell arms back in November of 2021 to the tune of between $650 to $750 million. So how do you evaluate the way that Biden is presenting himself in this op-ed with this last viewpoint that I just presented?
Well, it's more of the same. Joe Biden claimed repeatedly during his presidential campaign that he would end the war in Yemen. And when he came in January of 2021, Then in February, a few weeks after entering office, he claimed that he had reached a new agreement with Saudi Arabia and he was ending support for all offensive operations. Now, he claimed that the U.S. was continuing support for Saudi defensive operations. But of course, the very nature of the Saudi war is an aggressive war. It is a war that was launched in March 2015, bombing Saudi Arabia's southern neighbor, Yemen. And Saudi Arabia, with the support of the U.S., Britain, and France, has carried out tens of thousands of airstrikes. How can an airstrike be defensive? It's not defensive. So we see that from the very beginning, the Biden administration has been the master of trying to use this language that sounds like he's ending the war, that sounds like he's pursuing peace and diplomacy, but all he's really doing is redefining what the U.S. is doing in supporting Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen, and then saying that he made progress. And similarly now, he says that he's going to pressure Saudi Arabia to end the war in Yemen and then going to start selling offensive weapons. Are we really supposed to believe that if Saudi Arabia says, oh, we're ending the war in Yemen, but we buy all of these weapons from the U.S., are we really supposed to believe that Saudi Arabia is not going to use those weapons? Then why is it buying those weapons? It's clearly buying those weapons with the intent to use them. And maybe Saudi Arabia says, okay, we have officially ended operations, and then it unofficially continues waging this war. And we also have to be clear, when Biden says that Saudi Arabia is going to engage in diplomacy, does that mean that it's going to recognize the de facto government in Yemen that governs the majority of where the population of Yemen lives, which is the Sana'a government? Is Saudi Arabia ever going to recognize that government? And of course, the answer is very unlikely. Saudi Arabia is still going to recognize the puppet regime, which was unelected in the south, as the illegitimate government of Yemen. So that's not a diplomatic solution. That's just kicking the problem under the rug and pretending like it no longer exists.
Okay, let's break this down with the information you gave us, Yusuf Mowry. We're looking at the Socotra Island, where it is reported that the UAE is setting up a military base with Israeli cooperation and perhaps to have Israeli special operatives operating there along with the UAE. What type of purpose does that serve, and what are they doing to execute whatever military purposes they believe it serves them? If you can please explain that to us.
Well, they basically, so here's how it works in Yemen, right? With what's been, you know, has been empirically proven, the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, they've come to the realization that they will not win the war inside of Yemen. In other words, they understand that they will not be able to topple, they will not be able to dethrone the Sana'a government from power because, one, the Sana'a government has a large portion of support from the Yemeni people, and they've managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the Yemeni people. They've tried over the past 7 years to overthrow, to dethrone the Sana'a government, and they failed miserably across the board to achieve this goal. So now, plan B, if you will, they will no longer try to take over the capital, Sana'a. What they're going to do instead, actually, they're going to try to turn Yemen into another Gaza, whereby Yemen as a nation will be imprisoned. It will be besieged and surrounded with military bases to wage attack on demand anytime that they feel the need to do so. So just because they can't overthrow the government and just because they can't win the hearts and the minds of the Yemeni people, they're resorting to Plan B, which calls for the engulfing the entire nation with military bases and waging attacks anytime the Yemeni government, the Sana'a government, attempts to resuscitate the economy, anytime the Yemeni government attempts to rebuild its military and public institutions. They're basically hell-bent on keeping Yemen in the worst humanitarian crisis until they get the regime change that they want. So unless the U.S. and Israel and Saudi Arabia get the regime change that they so desperately want, they're going to keep the Yemeni people starving to death. They're going to keep this strangling blockade imposed on the country. They're going to continue their airstrikes. They're going to continue their military offensive from all four corners of Yemen. And this is what the Socotra Island is being used for. This is what the island of Ma'un is being used for. This is what the northwest-south is being used for in Yemen. Any place in Yemen, any area that's under the occupation of Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries is going to be used to continue waging this Saudi war on Yemen. And to answer your question, so this is what the plan is right now. Since they can't take over Yemen, since they can't get the regime change that they want, they're basically hell-bent on turning Yemen into another Gaza. They basically want it to be a country without a thriving economy. They basically want want Yemen to be without a military, and they want the country to be divided and in a state of chaos and instability.
When you want to break down the amount of incentive each entity has in this game, Ben Norton, I'm sorry, I shouldn't use the word game, in this process, we're looking at the United States, Saudi Arabia, obviously, and we're also looking, obviously, in the increasing role that Israel plays. It appears that the U.S. may be outnumbered when it comes to an incentive to have the scenario that our guest from Sana'a says to be executed, because even if Saudi Arabia, even if the U.S. does not want to pursue this war, Israel is pushing for that scenario that our guest from Sana'a is saying, and I'm sure that you have Saudi Arabia that perhaps maybe even laying out that as a condition in order for the situation or the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. to improve, and arms sales being one of those prerequisites of Saudi Arabia. Is that a possibility?
Well, I think so, but the reality is that for the United States, they are, speaking frankly, unfortunately, the United States government does not care about the people of Yemen. It never has. It was waging a drone war that killed many Yemeni civilians. The Trump administration carried out raids that killed Yemeni children. The U.S. government sees Yemen as a chip in a game. I mean, you use the term game. Unfortunately, that's the way these policymakers in Washington see the world. They see countries not as countries representing sovereign people of flesh and blood. They see the countries as potential allies or enemies. And George W. Bush famously said that the perspective of the U.S. government is you're either with us or you're against us. And the U.S. government is trying to force every country around the world to join its alliance in a new Cold War that it's waging on both China and Russia. And of course, Iran is a strategic partner of both China and Russia. And that further incentivizes the U.S. and apartheid Israel to work together to pressure all countries in West Asia to take aggressive actions against Iran, to try to isolate Iran and also, of course, isolate China and Russia. So unfortunately, in terms of what U.S. interests are, the U.S. has no interest whatsoever in protecting the Yemeni people. The Joe Biden administration may claim for public relations purposes and you know, its public speeches that it cares about human rights. But I'm sure that when Biden sits down with Mohammed bin Salman, he's going to say very clearly, look, we're against Iran, we're against China, we're against Russia. You just have to do something publicly to get all of these people criticizing me off of my back. He's going to tell MBS that you should say that you formally ended the war, and we're going to continue as you informally continue this war. And I think the guest from Sana'a is correct that the U.S. strategy is to turn Yemen into a new Gaza and to try to get everyone around the world to just forget about it. Okay. And allow Saudi Arabia to continue occupying it, blockading it, and continuing a war, but a quiet war, so the White House doesn't have to deal with public criticism.
All right. We just had Yusuf Mary. This is the last question. Israel's Lapid say that we have to do something about the Gaza blockade because it's not working. Why not push for a political solution like this truce was supposed to lay the groundwork for? Why go through all this other military-type complex engagement when a political solution could lay everything else to rest and for the peace to be established? 30 seconds, please.
Well, because they didn't get what they want. They did not get what they intended to happen in Yemen. They wanted the regime change to be in their favor. They wanted to install a puppet regime that would continue pushing and catering to the interests of Saudi Arabia and its Western partners. They did not get that because, you know, in 2014, the Yemeni people, they rose up and they said, enough is enough. We want to end to the decades of Western hegemony in our country. We want to establish an independent Yemeni nation that meets and that caters to the sentiments of the Yemeni people. And because of that, a revolution took to the streets, it overthrew the Western Saudi puppet regime from power. And now the fact is there's a new regime, and this is an independent government that the U.S. simply does not approve of and wants to get rid of as soon as possible.
Yusuf Mari from Sana'a, journalist and political analyst, thank you. Founder and editor of the independent news website Multipolarista, Ben Norton from Managua. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Welcome to Arab English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, where you could get the answers to all your questions. Well, today we have Dr. Karimi, scholar of religious studies, who will help us with the answers. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Dr. Karimi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Well, previously on Q&A on Islamic Belief, we were talking about the youth and actually the sins that and the temptation that might get into their way and makes their life difficult, though they are living in an age which is all temptation, and temptations are very colorful and they are right there. So one session was not enough, and today we're going to follow the recommendations upon how to control ourselves in order to have a more pretty youthful age.
Yeah, sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I talked about some theoretical points mentioned in the verses and narrations, and today I would like to share some more practical ways We talked about the fact that it's very important